You know how animals fatten themselves up to get ready for winter? Well, in the business world, companies try to slim down when they see rough times ahead. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdal. It's Tuesday, October 18th. Good to have you along. There's a special feeling you get during this time of year. The air gets cooler, the leaves change color, and companies issue their latest quarterly reports. Yes, we are in the middle of earnings season, and lately we've heard that several companies are preparing for a chillier economy. Hoarding their acorns, as one of our editors put it this morning. It's happening across the economy, but today we're going to start with the banking industry. This morning, Goldman Sachs said it's setting aside more cash to cover bad loans compared to the same time a year ago. Over the last few days, several other banks said they're doing the same thing, including Bank of America, JP Morgan Chase, and Wells Fargo. Marketplace's Justin Ho gets us started.
When the economy starts looking kind of scary, bank executives have to make a judgment call about their outstanding loans.
What does management think is the likelihood that all of those loans that they're carrying on their balance sheets are actually going to be paid off?
That's Catherine Judge, a law professor at Columbia. The idea, she says, is to set aside cash now in case borrowers default later. In fact, this is what banks did when the pandemic first started.
And that was because there was this huge shock to the economy. And they didn't know exactly, you know, what the effect was going to be. But all of them actually thought, like, look, you know, this is going to really hurt our borrowers. It's going to hurt households. It's going to hurt businesses.
But the economy looks a lot better today than it did in early 2020. Gerard Cassidy is a bank analyst at RBC Capital Markets. He says right now, people generally aren't having problems paying back their debt.
In fact, the current credit picture for the industry is very robust, both on the consumer side and commercial side.
That could change if a recession happens. People could lose their jobs and have trouble paying off bills. Companies could lose sales and have trouble servicing their debt. Karen Petru at Federal Financial Analytics says banks are essentially pulling out their sweaters ahead of the winter.
We might not need them. Maybe the winter will be warmer than we think, but we have the sweaters. We bought the sweaters. We're ready.
And if we get a mild recession, or if it doesn't even happen, Petru says it's no big deal to put those sweaters back. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Now on to the tech sector, which also seems to be prepping for a slowdown. Microsoft announced another round of layoffs on Monday. That news first reported by Axios and is said to affect fewer than 1,000 people. For context, Microsoft employs more than 200,000 people. Other tech companies are also cutting jobs and scaling back recruitment after years of rapid hiring. Marketplace's Lily Jamali has more.
Is the party over in tech? Rita McGrath at Columbia Business School says, yeah, for now.
All this crazy bubble capital that's been flowing into tech is now starting to come to its senses. And so we're a little bit in the hangover period after the party's done.
Microsoft declined to confirm the scope of the layoffs to Marketplace, but in a statement said, like all companies, it evaluates business priorities on a regular basis and adjusts accordingly. Demand for Microsoft's products exploded early in the pandemic, says Tejas Desai, research analyst at GlobalX ETFs. That includes its cloud franchise.
We witnessed that growth boom during the pandemic. Businesses of all shapes and sizes basically relied on cloud technologies to keep running.
The Xbox segment also did well, he says. But as everything from gaming to ad tech slows down, many tech companies are cutting headcount, some by 2 to 5%, says Wedbush Managing Director Dan Ives.
I think a lot of CEOs within the tech industry are bracing for what could be an extended period of pain. And that's why they're cutting ahead of that.
Those layoffs could benefit early-stage ventures, many of which are being funded right now, says Jose Benitez-Kong, head of talent at Humane, a mobile startup.
They basically have the pick of the litter in less competition than, say, 9 to 12 months ago.
He says those younger companies have an opportunity to grow, even in a downturn. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a bumpy ride, but things ended on an up note. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Sticking with the trend, Johnson & Johnson said today it too may cut some jobs as it contends with inflationary pressures and the strong dollar. But the maker of Tylenol and Band-Aid said lingering supply chain problems were starting to get better. The New York Fed's Global Supply Chain Pressure Index reports 5 straight months of easing supply chain pressures. Marketplace's Matt Levin explains why that is.
Let's start with the good news. It is way cheaper now to ship a container full of engine parts or plush dolls or whatever from China to L.A. Dale Rogers is a professor of logistics at Arizona State.
In 2021, a typical price was $20,000 to ship a container. Now we're at about $5,000 a container.
Those epic port backlogs are pretty much gone, too. The ports of L.A. and Long Beach don't look like the container ship DMV anymore. And many manufacturing companies have tried to reshore supply chains away from congested ports anyway, says consultant Paul Welliner at Deloitte.
So we are seeing companies trying to bring product, you know, in their supply chain closer to its point of use.
Welliner says the pandemic has also forced U.S. companies to invest more heavily in supply chain management, which is also bringing down costs. But maybe the biggest reason supply chains are getting unsnarled? That's the less good news.
Frankly, I think it's more a symptom of falling demand.
David Correll teaches logistics at MIT. That's partly consumer spending more on services, but also...
inflationary pressure has taken a bigger chunk out of people's wallet. We've seen lesser demand strain put on supply chains.
That could be a bad sign for economic growth, but good news for prices coming down in the long run. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
The Biden administration announced today that, for the first time ever, the federal government will hold an auction for offshore wind leases in the Pacific Ocean. The government already has a couple dozen leases on the East Coast for offshore wind farms. The December sale for the lease areas off the coast of California is the latest example of governments around the world embracing wind energy. Even, in some cases, governments that aren't quite in charge yet. In the UK, the awful economic fallout of the now-reversed tax-cutting plan has the opposition Labour Party basically measuring the curtains for when they expect to take over. The next national election is 2 years away, but part of Labour's plan to revive the British economy is, you guessed it, wind power. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Opposition leader Sir Keir Starmer unveiled his plan at his recent party conference. He pledged that a Labour government would create a company called Great British Energy to invest in wind, solar, tidal and other renewable sources of power for the direct benefit of the British people.
Because it is right for jobs, because it is right for growth, because it is right for energy independence from tyrants like Putin, then yes, conference, Great British Energy will be publicly owned.
The plan was wildly popular with his delegates, but what about the UK at large? In fact, says Matt Lawrence of the Commonwealth think tank, the principle of a taxpayer-funded energy company should be totally acceptable to the Brits.
The UK already has very extensive public ownership of renewable generating capacity. It's just that it's not owned by the British government.
Take offshore wind power. The UK has more of this than any other nation. These turbines supply around 14% of UK electricity. And yet, says Lawrence, foreign governments own around half this infrastructure, while the British government's stake is paltry.
The UK government only owns 0.03% of offshore wind capacity in its territorial waters.
Compare that with Denmark's 20% and Norway's 9% share. Even the Malaysian government and Munich City Council, he says, have a bigger stake in UK offshore wind than the British government. This must change, says Mika Minio-Paluello, who's with the trade union umbrella group, the TUC.
Continuing to sell off our wind, our sun, our natural resources to largely foreign publicly owned companies so that the profits go to people in other countries isn't a great strategy for economic success.
But neither is British public ownership, say critics of the Great British Energy Plan. They point to the turmoil here in the 1970s. Back then, a massive wave of strikes, many in the nationalised industries, paralysed the UK and swept Margaret Thatcher to power, who then, as this BBC report recalled, sold off many of the state-owned enterprises.
Electricity, gas, airlines. Few national assets were out of bounds.
Andrew Hilton, founder of the CSFI think tank, says that older Brits should not forget this grim chapter in their economic history.
Anybody who's over 50 ought to remember the shambles that Margaret Thatcher inherited when she took over and she found the public sector in a terrible mess.
Not only labour unrest due to militant trade unionism, he says, but waste, inefficiency and underinvestment. But if the Danes, the Norwegians, the French and others can do it, are the Brits incapable of running a state-owned energy company today?
Unfortunately, I would have to say we probably are incapable of doing it on the basis of our track record.
Andy Mayer, energy analyst with the Free Market Institute of Economic Affairs, also believes that with the protective cushion of state funding, Great British Energy would crowd out its rivals and morph into a monster.
A giant, too big to fail state corporation producing very expensive energy, no market competition, no pressure on prices for efficiency, as well as potentially insecurity of supply.
But that remains a minority view. 66% of Brits, according to a recent poll, would like to see the whole energy industry renationalised. There may not be an election for 2 years and public ownership may remain on the back burner. But there's little doubt which way the wind is blowing. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up,
a lot of travel guides call it the jewel of the Amalfi Coast.
It's beautiful, but is it worth the trip? First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 337 points, 1.1%, to close at 30,523. The Nasdaq rose 96 points, 0.9%, to end at 10,772. The S&P 500 was up 42 points, 1.1%, to finish at 3719. We heard from Justin earlier that banks are setting aside more cash amid economic uncertainty in case loans go bad. Well, today, strong earnings boosted bank stocks. Goldman Sachs jumped 2.3%. J.P. Morgan Chase ran up 2.5%. Morgan Stanley was up almost 3%. And multiple reports today that the Biden administration is set to sell off more of the nation's strategic petroleum reserve to help hold down surging gas prices. ExxonMobil added 0.1%. Chevron added 0.8%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 4.00%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. With all the concerns about a coming economic downturn, which, by the way, can sometimes become a self-fulfilling prophecy, it's worth keeping in mind some of the more nuanced consequences when the whole economy starts tightening its belt. For example, following the 2008 recession, people had fewer kids, which means, over the past few years, fewer students in elementary and middle school. which means we need fewer schools. In parts of the country losing school-age population, districts are closing schools they don't need. Sometimes they hold on to the buildings in hopes of more kids down the road. Sometimes they tear them down. And sometimes they sell them to people with big dreams. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has more on what happens to a school after it stops being a school.
Before showing off the former Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Elementary Middle School in Northwest Baltimore, Kelly Bacala lets a group of developers know they'll be in for some exercise.
The elevators are working. We are not able to use them. There are two keys involved that I do not have.
Thank you. Right. How many of them are there?
There's just one. So when I said elevators, that was a lie.
Bacala works for the city of Baltimore, which is selling the school.
Let's get started.
Oh, it's dark in here. Inside, everyone turns on their phone flashlights because the power is off in the building. It's been closed since 2020. The kids who would have come here now attend school more than a mile away. And where I see a former science classroom with kids' handprints still on a mural at the back, real estate developer Nicole Earl sees a cozy one-bedroom apartment.
I mean, it has the walls and the structure. I mean, you still have to add, you know, closets and bathrooms, but as you can see, there is some plumbing already in here.
This is the first chance for many developers to see inside the school, which was built in 1973.
Okay, everybody ready for the next floor? The next floor is going to have the cafeteria and the auditorium.
We check out the empty office.
The intercoms don't work. I did try them.
In the cafeteria, there's a sign that says the MLK Cafe. And there's a very funky smell.
Something may have ended its days there.
Bishop J. Charles Carrington Jr. is a pastor. He wants to make the school into a new headquarters for his church and is positive even about that scent.
It can be fixed. Bleach fixes everything.
Carrington says he may offer $1.5 million for the school. That money would go to the city's capital budget. Baltimore's taking bids from potential buyers who will have to buy more than just bleach. The city estimates the school needs at least $800,000 worth of work, no matter what it becomes. Teresa Stevens works in neighborhood development for Baltimore.
The focus is not so much making the funding, but getting that property no longer vacant and useful for you and I.
MLK is one in a series of schools Baltimore is closing as it deals with a fluctuating school-age population. The school only had 244 kids at the end, compared to the mid-80s when enrollment was over 950. It's a problem facing an increasing number of communities around the country.
Nobody really knows how many schools are vacant at any given point, but there's a lot.
Alan Malik is a senior fellow with the Center for Community Progress. He says to understand what's happening, you have to go back to when about half of these schools were built in the 1950s.
After World War II, we really did have an explosion of children.
Of a sort, it was the baby boom. Then, a few decades later, those boomers had kids of their own.
That's what they call an echo.
Me, for example, I'm part of that echo. After that, U.S. population growth leveled off, and since 2008, it's been dropping.
The world of demographers said, well, it's a short-term blip. When the economy picks up, it'll go back up again. But it didn't.
So maybe it's appropriate that one of the most successful reuses for schools is senior housing. That lets developers blend financing sources like low income and historical tax credits. Emily Dowdle is with the Nonprofit Reinvestment Fund.
And additionally, senior housing is unlikely to cause a fuss in a neighborhood. There's no late night parties.
Other potential buyers are charter schools, startups looking for office space, or people who just want the land. Back in Northwest Baltimore, 19-year-old Naya Garnett lives near the former Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Elementary Middle School and is disappointed it won't be a school.
Normally, with historical figures, you name stuff after them. Now you have something named after you, now it's closed. That kind of seems like, you know, what was it for?
Now what it's for is changing. And if public schools signal a city's investment in the future, it can be hard to acknowledge that future doesn't involve as many children. In Baltimore, I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
K Kids or not, one of the first things many people did once pandemic restrictions started lifting all over the world was hop on a plane and go on vacation. Those who could afford to get away had months of being stuck stateside to plan their dream getaways, and many Americans were flush with cash and ready to spend. But maybe you've noticed, as you scroll through your social media feeds, that a lot of the pictures from said vacation look kind of the same. Well, that's because popular tourist spots are just that, popular. Something that Rebecca Jennings, a senior correspondent for Vox, recently found out for herself during a visit to the Italian town of Positano. And she wrote about the experience, which she says was kind of a letdown. Rebecca, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Describe Positano and why you chose to focus on it for your piece, or perhaps picking on it for your piece.
So Positano is this very tiny town on the Amalfi Coast of Italy. A lot of travel guides call it the jewel of the Amalfi Coast. So basically what it looks like is all these little houses that are in pastel colors are stacked against the cliffside, and there's a little bay, and it's very like crystal blue waters. Every day there are about 12,000 people there, but it's only built for about 4,000.
Wow. So you decided to go. I'm curious what your experience there revealed to you about how people are traveling in general these days.
Sure. So this is a really tiny resort town. The Amalfi Coast has been kind of a vacation land for the uber rich. But with travel being, you know, so much more accessible than it ever has been at like any point in history, really, for, you know, a middle class person, you know, you can go to all these places, but that doesn't mean that you're going to have, you know, a luxurious experience. And I think that was something that really jumped out to me. I still really enjoyed the experience, but the whole time I was like, man, this is really reflective of like what Instagram travel is.
What does it mean for the local residents when so much of the local economy hangs on tourism in this town and many other tourist towns all over the world?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's led to a lot of tension. You get a lot of local politics where it's like, okay, are we catering too much to the tourists versus, you know, the locals? And I know that's happening on the Amalfi Coast, where there's one road that you can drive on that goes to all the towns on the Amalfi Coast. And you will sit there for like potentially hours because of how heavy the traffic is, because people renting cars and, you know, wanting to see every stop. So they actually made a law where only cars that ended in a certain license plate number can drive on every other day of the week. Wow. And obviously there's some people who find this really good and stimulating for the economy, and some people who find this just like completely erasing local culture. And that's just going to be a point of tension no matter where you are in the world.
You wrote that traveling right now feels like walking into a Chanel store, but never being able to put on the clothes. But people generally avoid going to a store where they know they can't buy anything. And yet, even budget travelers are still going to these destinations where those beautiful shots are really only from places that rich people can afford to go. Why is this happening?
Yeah, because I think what all those pictures that we see are is marketing. You know, they're beautiful pictures, but that doesn't mean they're accessible to all, unfortunately. I think travelers who aren't willing to shell out, you know, $5,000 a night hotel stays, you'll have so much more fun going somewhere else that is more catered to you. Like, I have no desire to go to someplace like Monaco, because it's like, what am I going to do in Monaco? Like, walk around and feel really poor? Like, I have no desire to do that. So, yeah.
Having been to Monaco, that is exactly what you do.
Good to know.
How has your experience in Positano changed the way that you're going to travel moving forward?
I think I'm going to spend a lot less time taking the reviews of other people super, super seriously. And I think lingering more in one place rather than trying to see everything, I think, is an important thing.
Rebecca Jennings is a senior correspondent at Vox. Her piece, "The Instagram Capital of the World is a Terrible Place to Be." Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
This final note on the way out today from Bloomberg, which reports on new research from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York about the time Americans are saving with more of us working from home. U.S. workers have reclaimed 60 million hours by not having to commute. And what are folks doing instead? Mostly getting more sleep. I'm long-winded, so no time for economic context today. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Dylan Mietinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the executive director, and I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
Hey, everyone. It's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.